Chapter 14. White Plumes. The Silver Circuit was misnamed at first glance, but Ebudar liked grand names, and sometimes it seemed that the worse they fit, the better. The grimiest tavern Matt had seen in the city, smelling of very old fish, bore the name of the Queen's Glory in Radiance. While the Golden Crown of Heaven graced a dim hole across the river in the Rahad, with only a blue door to mark it, where black stains from old knife fights splotched the grimy floor. The Silver Circuit was for racing horses. Removing his hat, he fanned himself with the broad brim, and went so far as to loosen the black silk scarf he wore to hide the scar around his neck. The morning air shimmered with heat already, yet crowds packed the two long earthen banks that flanked the course where the horse would run up and back. That was all there was to the Silver Circuit. The murmur of voices almost drowned out the cries of gulls overhead. There was no charge to watch, so salt workers in the white vest of their guild, and gaunt-faced farmers who had fled from the dragon-sworn inland, rubbed shoulders with ragged tarabanners wearing transparent veils across their thick mustaches, weavers in vests with vertical stripes, printers in horizontal stripes, and dyers with hands stained to the elbow. The unrelieved black of Amadisian countrymen, buttoned to the neck, though the wearers seemed about to sweat to death, stood alongside Mirandian village dresses with long, colorful aprons, so narrow they must be only for show, and even a handful of copper-skinned Domani, the men in short coats if they wore one, the women in wool or linen so thin it clung like silk. There were apprentices and laborers from the docks and warehouses, tanners, who had a small space around them in the crowd because of the smell of their work, and filthy-faced street children watched closely because they would steal whatever they could lay hand to. There was little silver among the working people, though. All of them were above the thick hemp ropes strung on posts. Below was for those who did have silver and gold. The well-born, the well-dressed, and the well-to-do. Smug men-servants poured punch into silver cups for their masters, fluttery maids waved feathered fans to cool their mistresses, and there was even a capering fool with white-painted face and jingling brass bells on his black-and-white hat and coat. Haughty men in high-crowned velvet hats strutted with slender swords on their hips, their hair-brushing silk coats slung across their shoulders and held by gold or silver chains between the narrow, embroidered lapels. Some of the women had hair shorter than the men, and some longer, arranged in as many ways as there were women. They wore wide hats with plumes, or sometimes fine netting, to obscure their faces, and gowns usually cut to show bosom, whether in the local style or from elsewhere. The nobles, beneath brightly colored parasols, glittered with rings and earrings, necklaces and bracelets in gold and ivory and fine gems, as they stared down their noses at everyone else. Well-fed merchants and moneylenders, with just a touch of lace and perhaps one pin or a ring bearing a fat, polished stone, humbly bowed or curtsied to their betters, who very likely owed them vast sums. Fortunes changed hands at the Silver Circuit, and not just in wagers. It was said lives and honor changed hands, too, below the ropes. Replacing his hat, Matt raised his hand, and one of the bookers came, a hatchet-faced woman with a nose like an awl, spreading bony hands as she bowed, murmuring the ritual, "As my lord wishes to wager, so shall I write truly." The Ebudari accent managed to be soft, despite clipping the ends off some words. "The book is open." Like the saying, the open book embroidered on the breast of her red vest came from a time long past, when the wagers were written into a book. But he suspected he was the only one there who knew that. He remembered many things he had never seen, from times long gone to dust. With a quick glance at the odds for the morning's fifth race, chalked on the slate the Pullman held up behind the red-vested woman, he nodded. Wind was only the third favorite, despite his victories. He turned to his companion. "Put it all on Wind, Nalesian." The tyrant hesitated, fingering the point of his oiled black beard. Sweat glistened on his face, yet he kept his coat with its fat, blue-striped sleeves fastened to the top, and wore a square cap of blue velvet that did nothing to keep the sun off. All of it, Matt? He spoke softly, trying to keep the woman from hearing. The odds could change any time until you actually offered your wager.
Burn my soul, but that little piebald looks fast, and so does that pale dun gelding with the silvery mane.
They were the favorites today. New to the city, and like all things new, of great expectation. Matt did not bother to glance toward the 10 horses entered in the next race that were parading at one end of the course. He had already taken a good look while putting Oliver up on wind.
All of it. Some idiot clubbed the piebald's tail. He's already half mad from the flies.
The dun is showy, but he has a bad angle to his fetlocks. He may have won some in the country, but he'll finish last today. Horses were one thing he knew on his own. His father had taught him, and Abel Cawthon had a sharp eye for horseflesh.
He looks more than showy to me, Nalesian grumbled, but he was not arguing any more.
The booker blinked as Nalesian, sighing, pulled purse after fat purse from his bulging coat pockets. At one point she opened her mouth to protest, but the illustrious and honored guild of bookers always claimed it would take any wager in any amount. They even wagered with shipowners and merchants as to whether a ship would sink or prices change. Rather, the guild itself did, not individual bookers. The gold went into one of her iron-strapped chests, each carried by a pair of fellows with arms as thick as Matt's legs. Her guards, hard-eyed and bent-nosed in leather vests that showed arms still thicker, held long, brass-bound cudgels. Another of her men handed her a white token bearing a detailed blue fish. Every booker had a different sigil. And she wrote the wager, the name of the horse, and a symbol indicating the race, on the back with a fine brush that she took from a lacquered box held by a pretty girl. Slim, with big dark eyes, the girl directed a slow smile at Matt. The hatchet-faced woman certainly did not smile. Bowing again, she slapped the girl casually and walked off whispering to her Pullman, who hastily wiped his slate with a cloth. When he held it up again, wind was listed at the shortest odds. Rubbing her cheek surreptitiously, the girl scowled back at Matt as though the slap had been his fault.
"I hope your luck is in," Nalesian said, holding the token carefully for the ink to dry.
Bookers could be touchy about paying on a token with smeared ink, and no one was touchier than an Ebu Dari.
"I know you don't lose often, but I've seen it happen. Burn me, but I have. There's a lass I mean to step out with at the dancing tonight. Just a seamstress."
He was a lord, though not a bad fellow, really, and such things seemed important to him.
"But pretty enough to dry your mouth. She likes trinkets, golden trinkets. She likes fireworks, too. I hear some illuminators are setting up for tonight. You'll be interested in that. But its trinkets make her smile. She won't be friendly if I cannot afford to make her smile, Matt."
"You'll make her smile," Matt said absently.
The horses were still walking in a circle above the starting poles. Oliver sat proudly on Wynne's back, broad mouth grinning to split his more than plain face from jug ear to jug ear. In Ebu Dari races, all the riders were boys. A few miles inland, they used girls. Oliver was the smallest here today, the lightest, not that the leggy gray gelding needed the advantage.
"You'll make her laugh till she can't stand up."
Nalesian gave him a frown he barely noticed. The man should know gold was one thing Matt never had to worry about. He might not always win, but close enough. His luck had nothing to do with whether wind won anyway. Of that he was sure. Gold did not concern him, but Oliver did. There was no rule against the boys using their switches on each other instead of their mounts. In every race so far, wind had broken to the lead and stayed there. But if Oliver took any hurt, even just a bruise, Matt would never hear the end. Not from Mistress Annan, his innkeeper, not from Nynaeve or Elaine, not from Avienda or Brigitta. The one-time Maiden of the Spear and the peculiar woman Elaine had taken as a warder were the last he would have expected to gush with maternal feelings. Yet they had already tried to move the boy out of the Wandering Woman behind his back and into the Tarasen Palace.
Anywhere with so many Aes Sedai was the last place for Alvar, or for anybody. But one bump, and instead of telling Brigida and Avienda they had no right to take the boy, Setala Anan would likely hustle him off there herself. Alvar would probably cry himself to sleep if he was not allowed to race anymore. But women never understood these things. For about the 1,000th time, Matt cursed Nalesian for sneaking Alvar and Wynne to those first races. Of course, they had to find something to fill all the idle hours on their hands, but they could have found something else. Cutting purses could have been no worse in the women's eyes. "Here's the thief-catcher," Nalesian said, stuffing the token into his coat. He did not quite sneer. "Much good he's done so far. We'd have done better to bring another 50 soldiers instead." Julin strode through the crowd purposefully, a dark, hard man using a slender bamboo staff as tall as himself for a walking stick. With a flat-topped conical red Tarabaner cap on his head and a plain coat, tight to the waist, then flaring to his boot tops, well-worn and plainly not the coat of someone rich, he normally would not have been allowed below the ropes, but he made out to study the horses and ostentatiously bounced a fat coin on his palm. Several of the booker's guards looked at him suspiciously, but the gold crown let him pass. "Well," Matt said sourly, tugging his hat low, once the thief-catcher reached him. "No. Let me tell you. They slipped out of the palace again. No one saw them go again. Nobody has any bloody idea where they are again." Julin tucked the coin carefully into his coat pocket. He would make no wager. He seemed to save every copper that came into his hands. "All four of them took a closed coach from the palace to a landing on the river, where they hired a boat. Tom hired another to follow and see where they're going. Nowhere dark or unpleasant, I'd say, by their clothes. But it is true, nobles wear silk to crawl in the mud." He grinned at Nalesian, who folded his arms and pretended to be engrossed in the horses. The grin was a mere baring of teeth. They were both Tyran, but the gap between noble and common stood wide in tier, and neither man liked the other's company. "Women!" Several finely dressed specimens nearby turned to eye Matt askance from beneath bright parasols. He frowned right back, though two were pretty, and they set to laughing and chattering among themselves, as though he had done something amusing. A woman would do a thing until you were sure she always would, then do something else just to fuddle you. But he had promised Rand to see Elaine safely to Camelin, and Nynaeve and Egwene with her. And he had promised Egwene to see the other two safe on this trip to Abu Dhar, not to mention Avienda. That was the price of getting Elaine to Camelin. Not that they had told him why they needed to be here. Oh, no. Not that they had spoken 20 words to him since arriving in the bloody city. "I'll see them safe," he muttered under his breath, "if I have to stuff them into barrels and haul them to Camelin in a cart." He might be the only man in the world who could say that about Aes Sedai without looking over his shoulder, maybe even including Rand and those fellows he was gathering. He touched the foxhead medallion hanging under his shirt to make sure it was there, though he never took it off, even to bathe. It did have flaws, but a man liked to be reminded. "Taraben must be terrible now for a woman not used to taking care of herself," Julin murmured. He was watching three veiled men in tattered coats and baggy, once-white trousers scramble up the bank ahead of a pair of bookman's guards waving their clubs. No rule said the poor could not come below the ropes, but the booker's guards did. The two pretty women who eyed Matt appeared to be making a private wager on whether the Tarabunners would outrun the guards. "We've more than enough women right here without sense to come in out of the rain," Matt told him. "Go back to that boat landing and wait for Tom. Tell him I need him as soon as possible. I want to know what those fool bloody women are up to." Julin's look did not quite call him a fool. They had, after all, been trying to find out exactly that for over a month now, ever since coming here. With a last glance at the fleeing men, he sauntered back the way he had come, once more bouncing the coin in his hand. Frowning, Matt peered across the race course. It was barely 50 paces to the crowd on the other side, and faces leaped out at him.
a bent, white-haired old man with a hooked nose, a sharp-faced woman under a hat that seemed mostly plumes, a tall fellow who looked like a stork in green silk and gold braid, a nicely plump, full-mouthed young woman who appeared about to come out of her dress at the top. The longer the heat continued, the fewer and thinner garments women in Ebudar wore. But for once he hardly gave them any notice. Weeks had gone by since he so much as glimpsed the women who concerned him now. Brigida certainly needed no one to hold her hand. A hunter for the horn, anyone who troubled her would be in a deep hole by his estimation. And Avienda? All she needed was someone to keep her from stabbing everybody who looked at her crossways. As far as he was concerned, she could knife whoever she wanted, so long as it was not Elaine. For all the bloody daughter-heir walked about with her nose in the air, she turned moon-eyed around Rand, and for all Avienda behaved as if she would stab any man who glanced her way, she did the same. Rand usually knew how to deal with women, but he had jumped into a bear pit letting that pair come together. It was a short road to disaster, and why ruin had not happened was beyond Matt. For some reason, his eyes drifted back to the sharp-faced woman. She was pretty, if vulpine. About Nynaeve's age, he estimated. It was hard to tell at the distance, but he could judge women as well as he could horses. Of course, women could fool you faster than any horse. Slim? Why did she make him think of straw? What he could see of her hair beneath the plumed hat was dark. No matter. Brigida and Avienda could do without his shepherding, and normally he would have said the same of Elaine and Nynaeve, however wrong-headed, conceited, and downright pushy they could be. That they had been sneaking out all this time said differently, though. Wrong-headedness was the key. They were the sort who berated a man for meddling and chased him away, then berated him again for not being there when he was needed. Not that they would admit he was needed, even then, not them. Raise a hand to help, and you were interfering. Do nothing, and you were an untrustworthy wastrel. The fox-faced woman across the way popped into his view again. Not straw. A stable. Which made no more sense. He had had fine times in stables with many a young woman, and some not so young. But she wore modestly cut blue silk with a high neck right under her chin, trimmed in snowy lace, and more spilling over her hands. A lady, and he avoided noblewomen like death. Playing haughty like a harp, expecting a man always to be at their beck and call. Not Matt Cawthon. Strangely, she was fanning herself with a spray of white plumes. Where was her maid? A knife? Why should she make him think of a knife? And fire? Something burning, anyway. Shaking his head, he tried to focus on what was important. Other men's memories of battles and courts and lands vanished centuries ago filled holes in his own, places where his own life suddenly went thin or was not there at all. He could remember fleeing the two rivers with Moraine and Lan quite clearly, for example, but almost nothing more until reaching Camelon, and there were gaps before and after as well. If whole years of his own growing up lay beyond recall, why should he expect to recollect every woman he had met? Maybe she reminded him of some woman dead 1,000 years or more. The light knew that happened often enough. Even Brigida sometimes tickled his memory. Well, there were 4 women here and now who had his brain tied in knots. They were what was important. Nynaeve and the others were avoiding him as if he had fleas. 5 times he had been to the palace, and the once they would see him, it was to say they were too busy for him, and send him away like an errand boy. It all added up to one thing. They thought he would interfere with whatever they were up to, and the only reason he would do that was if they were putting themselves in danger. They were not complete fools. Idiots often, but not complete fools. If they saw danger, there was danger. Some places in this city, being a stranger or showing a coin could bring a knife in your ribs, and not even channeling would stop it if they did not see it in time. And here he was, with Nalesian and 12 good men from the band, not to mention Tom and Julin, who actually had rooms in the servants' quarters of the palace, all left to twiddle their thumbs.
Those thick-skulled women were going to get their throats cut yet.
"Not if I can help it," he growled.
"What?" Nalesian said. "Look, they're lining up, Matt. The light burned my soul, I hope you're right. That piebald doesn't look half-crazed to me, he looks eager."
The horses were prancing, taking their places between tall poles stuck in the ground, with streamers tailing from the tops of them in a warm breeze, blue and green and every color, some striped. 500 paces down the track of hard-beaten red clay, an identical number of streamered poles made another row. Each rider had to round the same colored streamer as floated to his right at the start, and then return. A booker stood at either end of the line of horses, just to the front, a round woman and a rounder man, each with a wife's scarf held overhead. The bookers took turns at this, and were not allowed to accept wagers on a race they started.
"Burn me," Nalesian muttered.
"Light man, be easy. You'll tickle your seamstress under the chin yet." A roar drowned the last word as the scarves came down, and the horses surged forward, even the sound of their hooves submerged in the noise of the crowd. In 10 strides, Wind had the lead, Alver lying close on his neck, with the silver-maned Dun only a head back. The piebald trailed in the pack, where the rider's switches already rose and fell frantically.
"I told you the Dun was dangerous," Nalesian moaned. "We shouldn't have wagered everything."
Matt did not bother to answer. He had another purse in his pocket, and loose coins besides. He called the purse his seed. With that, with even a few of the coins in it, and a game of dice, he could repair his fortunes, whatever happened this morning. Halfway down the course, Wind still held the lead, the Dun clinging close a full length ahead of the next horse. The piebald was running fifth. After the turn would come the hazard. Boys on trailing animals were known to slash at those who rounded the stakes ahead of them. Following the horses, Matt's eyes swept across the sharp-faced woman again, and snapped back. The shouts and screams of the crowd faded. The woman was shaking her fan at the horses and jumping excitedly, but suddenly he saw her in pale green and a rich gray cloak, her hair caught in a frothy net of lace, skirts held up delicately as she picked her way across a stable not far from Camelin. Rand still lay there moaning in the straw, even if the fever seemed gone. At least he was not shouting any more at people who were not there. Matt eyed the woman suspiciously as she knelt beside Rand. Maybe she could help as she claimed, but Matt did not trust as he once had. What was a fine lady like this doing in a village stable? Caressing the ruby-tipped hilt of the dagger hidden by his coat, he wondered why he had ever trusted. It never paid. Never. "Weak as a day-old kitten," she was saying as she reached beneath her cloak. "I think..." A knife appeared in her hand so suddenly, streaking for Matt's throat, that he would have been dead if he had not been ready. Dropping flat, he seized her wrist, just pushing it away from him, the curved Shadarlogoth blade sweeping out to lie against her slim white neck. The woman froze, trying to look down at the sharp edge dimpling her skin. He wanted to slice, especially when he saw where her own dagger had stabbed into the stable wall. Around the slim blade, a black circle of char grew, and a thin gray tendril of smoke rose from wood about to burst into flame. Shivering, Matt rubbed a hand across his eyes. Just carrying that Shadarlogoth knife had nearly killed him, eating those holes in his memories. But how could he forget a woman who tried to kill him? A dark friend, she had admitted as much, who tried to kill him with a dagger that set a bucket of water near boiling when they tossed it in after securing her in the tack room. A dark friend who had been hunting Rand in him. What chance she was in Ebu Dar when he was, at the races on the same day? Taviren might be the answer. He liked thinking of that about as much as he did the Horn of Bloody Valir. But the fact was, the Forsaken knew his name. That stable had not been the last time dark friends tried putting an end to Matt Cawthon. He staggered as Nalesian suddenly began pounding his back.
"Look at him, Matt! Light of heaven, look at him!"
The horses had rounded the far poles and were well on their way back. Head stretched out, mane and tail flying behind, Wind streaked down the course with Alver clinging to his back like a part of the saddle. The boy rode as if he had been born there. Four lengths behind, the piebald pounded furiously, rider working his switch in a futile effort to close. Just like that, they slashed across the finish line, with the next nearest horse another three lengths back. The white-maned dun came last. The moans and mutters of losing betters overwhelmed the shouts of winners. Losing tokens made a shower of white onto the track, and dozens of the booker's servants rushed out to clear them away before the next race.
"We have to find that woman, Matt. I'd not put it past her to run off without paying out so much as she owes us."
From what Matt had heard, the Booker's Guild was more than harsh the first time one of its members tried anything of the sort, and deadly the second. But they were commoners, and that was enough for Nalesian. "She's standing right over there in plain view," Matt gestured without taking his eyes from the fox-faced dark friend. Glaring at a token, she hurled it to the ground and even lifted her skirts to stamp on it. Plainly not a wager on wind. Still grimacing, she began threading her way through the crowd. Matt stiffened. She was leaving.
"Gather our winnings, Nalesian, then take Oliver back to the inn. If he misses his reading lesson, you'll kiss the Dark One's sister before Mistress Anon lets him out for another race."
"Where are you going?"
"I saw a woman who tried to kill me," Matt said over his shoulder.
"Give her a trinket next time," Nalesian shouted after him.
Following the woman was no trouble, what with that white-plumed hat for a banner bobbing through the crowd on the other side. The earthen banks gave way to a large open area, where brightly lacquered coaches and sedan chairs waited under the watchful eyes of drivers and bearers. Matt's horse Pips was one of scores being guarded by members of the ancient and worshipful Guild of Stablemen. There was a guild for most things in Ebu Dar, and woe to anyone who trespassed on their ground. He paused, but she walked on by the conveyances that had brought those with position or money. No maid, and now not even a chair. No one walked in this heat who had money to ride. Had Milady come on hard times? The Silver Circuit lay just south of the tall, white-plastered city wall, and she strolled up the 100 paces or so of road to the broad-pointed arch of the Muldine Gate and in. Trying to appear casual, Matt followed. The gateway was 10 spans of dim tunnel, but her hat stood out among the folk passing through. People who had to walk seldom wore plumes. She seemed to know where she was going on the other side. The plumes wove through the crowds ahead of him, unhurried but always moving forward. Ebu Dar shone white in the morning sun, white palaces with white columns and screened wrought-iron balconies cheek by jowl with white-plastered weaver's shops and fishmongers and stables, great white houses with louvered shutters hiding their arched windows, beside white inns with painted signs hanging in front, and open markets under long roofs where live sheep and chickens, calves and geese and ducks made a barnyard din alongside their fellows already butchered and hanging. All white, stone or plaster, except here and there bands of red or blue or gold, on turnip-shaped domes and pointed spires that had balconies running around them. There were squares everywhere, always with a statue larger than life on a pedestal or a splashing fountain that only emphasized the heat, always packed with people. Refugees filled the city, and merchants and traders of every sort. Never a trouble but brought profit to somebody. What Saldaya had once sent into Ara Daman now came downriver to Ebu Dar, and so did what Amadisia had traded into Tarabon. Everyone scurried, for a coin or 1,000, for a bite to eat today. The aroma that hung in the air was equal parts perfume, dust, and sweat. Somehow, it all smelled desperate. Barge-filled canals sliced through the city, crossed by dozens of bridges, some so narrow that two people would have to squeeze past one another, others large enough that shops actually lined them, hanging out over the water. On one of those, he suddenly realized that the white-plumed hat had stopped. People flowed around him as he did, too. The shops here were really just open wooden nooks, with heavy plank shutters that could be let down to close them off at night. Raised overhead now, the shutters displayed signs for the shops. The one above the plumed hat showed a golden scale and hammer, sign of the Goldsmiths' Guild, though plainly not of a particularly prosperous member. Through a momentary gap in the crowd, he saw her look back and turned hurriedly to the narrow stall to his right. On the wall at the back hung finger rings and boards displaying stones cut in all sorts of designs.
"My lord wishes a new signet ring?"
the bird-like fellow behind the counter asked, bowing and dry-washing his hands. Skinny as a rail, he had no worry of anyone stealing his goods. Cramped into a corner on a stool sat a one-eyed fellow who might have had trouble standing upright inside the cubicle, with a long cudgel studded with nail heads propped between his massive knees.
"I can cut any design, as my lord can see, and I have tryings for size, of course."
"Let me see that one." Matt pointed at random. He needed some reason to stand here until she went on. It might be a good time to decide exactly what he was going to do.
"A fine example of the long style, my lord. Much in favor now. Gold, but I work in silver as well. Why, I think the size is right, if my lord will care to try it on. My lord may wish to examine the fine detail of the carving. Does my lord prefer gold or silver?"
With a grunt that he hoped might be taken for answer to some of that, Matt shoved the proffered ring onto the second finger of his left hand and pretended to examine the dark oval of carved stone. All he really saw was that it was as long as the joint of his finger. Head down, he studied the woman from the corner of his eye, the best he could through gaps that opened in the throng. She was holding a wide, flat gold necklace up to the light. There was a civil guard in Ebudar, but not a very efficient one, seldom to be seen on the streets. If he denounced her, it would be his word against hers, and even if he was believed, a few coins might let her walk free even on that charge. The civil guard was cheaper than a magistrate, but either could be bought unless someone powerful was watching, and then, if enough gold lay in the offer. A swirl in the crowd suddenly turned into a white cloak, conical helmet and long mail shirt gleaming like silver, snowy cloak with the flaring golden sun billowing as he strode along, confident that a path would clear for him. Which it certainly did. Few willingly put themselves in the way of the Children of the Light. Yet for every eye that slid away from the stone-faced man, another beamed on him approvingly. The sharp-faced woman not only looked at him openly, she smiled. A charge laid against her might or might not put her in prison, but it could be the spark to ignite a city full of tales about dark friends in the Tarasin Palace. White cloaks were good at whipping up mobs, and to them, Aes Sedai were dark friends. As the Child of the Light passed her, she laid down the necklace, apparently regretful, and turned to go.
"Does the style suit my lord?"
Matt gave a start. He had forgotten the skinny man and the ring, too. "No, I don't want—" Frowning, he tugged at the ring again. It would not budge.
"No need to pull. You might crack the stone."
Now that he was no longer a potential customer, Matt was no longer my lord either. Sniffing, the fellow kept a sharp eye on him, lest he try to run.
"I have some grease. Daryl, where's that grease pot?"
The guard blinked and scratched his head as if wondering what a grease pot was. The white-plumed hat was halfway to the end of the bridge already.
"I'll take it," Matt snapped.
No time for haggling. Hauling up a fistful of coins from his coat pocket, he slapped them down on the counter, mostly gold and a little silver.
"Enough?"
The ringmaker's eyes bulged.
"A little too much,"
he quavered uncertainly. His hands hesitated above the coins, then two fingers pushed a pair of silver pennies toward Matt.
"So much?"
"Give them to Daryl," Matt growled as the bloody ring slipped from his finger. The skinny man was hurriedly raking up the rest of the coins. Too late to try backing out of the purchase. Matt wondered by just how much he had overpaid. Stuffing the ring into his pocket, he hastened after the dark friend. The hat was nowhere to be seen. Twinned statues decorated the end of the bridge, pale marble women over a tall span, each with one breast bared and a hand raised to point toward something in the sky. In Ebudar, a bare chest symbolized openness and honesty. Ignoring stares, he climbed up beside one of the women, steadying himself with an arm around her waist. A street ran along the canal, and two more split off at angles ahead, all full of people in carts, sedan chairs, and wagons and coaches. Someone shouted in a rough voice about real women being warmer, and a number in the crowd laughed. White plumes appeared from behind a blue lacquered coach on the left-hand fork. Leaping down, he pushed up the street after her, ignoring the curses of those he bumped. It was an odd chase. In the mass of people, with wagons and coaches constantly getting in his way, he could not keep a clear sight of the hat from the street. Scampering up the broad marble steps of a palace, he got another glimpse, then scurried back down to shove ahead. The rim of a tall fountain gave him yet another view, then an upended barrel against a wall, and a crate that had just been unloaded from an ox cart. Once he clung to the side of a wagon until the driver threatened him with her whip. With all the climbing and looking, he did not narrow the dark friend's lead very much. But then, he still had no notion what to do if he caught her. Suddenly, when he hoisted himself up onto the narrow coping along the face of one of the big houses, she was not there anymore. Frantically, he looked up and down the street. The white plumes no longer waved through the crowd. In easy sight were half a dozen houses, much like the one he was clinging to, several palaces of various sizes, two inns, three taverns, a cutler's shop with a knife and a pair of scissors on its sign, a fishmonger with a board painted in 50 kinds of fish, two rug weavers with unrolled carpets spread on tables beneath awnings, a tailor's shop, and four cloth sellers, two shops displaying lacquerware, a goldsmith, a silversmith, a livery stable. The list was too long. She could have gone into any of them, or none. She might have taken a turn he had not seen. Jumping down, he settled his hat, muttering under his breath, and saw her, almost at the top of the wide stairs leading to a palace nearly across from him, already half hidden by the tall fluted columns out front. The palace was not large, with only two slim spires and a single pear-shaped dome banded in red, but Ebu Dari palaces always gave the ground floor to servants and kitchens and the like. The better rooms were high, to catch the breezes. Doorman, liveried in black and yellow, bowed deeply and swung the carved doors wide before she reached them. A servant inside curtsied, apparently saying something, and immediately turned to lead her deeper. She was known. He would have wagered everything on it. For a while after the doors closed, he stood there studying the palace. Not the richest in the city by far, but only a noble would dare build its like. "But who in the pit of doom lives there?" he muttered finally, plucking off his hat to fan himself. Not her, not when she had to walk. A few questions in the taverns along the street would tell him, and word of his queries would seep to the palace, sure as dirt soiled your hands. Someone said, "Caradin." It was a scrawny, white-haired fellow, lounging nearby in the shade. Matt looked at him questioningly, and he grinned, showing gaps in his teeth. His stooped shoulders and sad, weathered face did not fit his fine gray coat. Despite a bit of lace at his neck, he was the very picture of hard times.
"You asked who lived there. The Chelsane Palace is let to Jakim Cardin."
Matt's hat paused. "You mean the White Cloak Ambassador?"
"Aye, and Inquisitor of the Hand of the Light."
The old man tapped a gnarled finger against the side of his beak of a nose. Both looked to have been broken several times.
"Not a man to bother unless you must, and then I'd think three times."
Unconsciously, Matt hummed a bit of Storm from the Mountains. Not a man to bother indeed. Questioners were the nastiest of the White Cloaks. A White Cloak Inquisitor who had a dark friend come to call. "Thank you." Matt gave a start. The fellow was gone, swallowed up in the crowd. Strange, but he had looked familiar. Maybe another long-dead acquaintance drifting out of those old memories. Maybe... It hit him like an illuminator's night flower exploding inside his head. A white-haired man with a hooked nose. That old man had been at the Silver Circuit, standing not far from the woman who had just gone into Cardin's rented palace. Turning his hat in his hands, he frowned uneasily at the palace. The mire never held a bog like this one. He could feel the dice tumbling in his head suddenly, and that was always a bad sign.